This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. This is your host, Tim Link, and I'm so glad you're joining us today. Super excited. We're going to have an old friend, of course, one of the best out there. He's a New York Times number one best-selling author, James Rollins. James is going to come back on the show here. Talk about his latest book, Archangel, and it's, of course, a Sigma Force novel. So we're going to talk to James a little bit about the novel, some of the intrigue without giving out all the secrets. And then, of course, we won't let him get away without telling us about how he can master the craft like he does. So it's going to be fun, exciting, educational, all kinds of good stuff. So we're super excited. So everybody hang tight. We'll come back right after this commercial break. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Joining me now is number one New York Times best-selling author, James Rollins. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tim. Always happy to be here talking about writing and about animals, two topics I love.
Yeah, absolutely. We love it too. And we'll definitely won't let you get off the hook without telling us about the animals that may or may not be in the book and those that are in and around your feet right now. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So we got the latest book, Archangel. It's part of the Sigma Force novel and the international thriller series. And super excited to read through the book. Tell us a little bit about what can we expect from this this particular one.
Well, you know, all my novels, I love dealing with mythology. I love dealing with sort of these undiscovered worlds, you know, hidden here on Earth. And so this book deals with lost continents and mysterious lost libraries. It starts out with this very violent murder of a Vatican archivist who was researching the lost library of the czars. It's called the Golden Library. It vanished after Ivan the Terrible died, his vast archive of books that supposedly went back all the way back to the lost library of Alexandria. So everybody's been searching for this library up until today. They're still searching for the location of this hidden library. And of course, my Vatican archive has stumbled upon a clue to that library, which of course ends up with his untimely death. But before he dies, he's able to get a coded message warning that there's not just the hint about the library, but there's a terrifying secret about the library, one that can just threaten the world. Sigma Force, of course, is called in after the murder to try to figure out what happened. You know, A, where is this missing trove of ancient books? And it leads to basically a trail far into the Arctic in search for a mysterious lost continent that's been rumored to be up in the Arctic going back for centuries. And in this book, you're going to discover there actually could be a lost continent in the Arctic. And I'm not going to tell you how that comes about. You're going to have to read the book.
There you go. I love it. I love it. And I love all your novels and the fact that, you know, I could see there's just a ton of research that goes into it. And you're applying all these different things. You know, you got a mystery, you got a thriller, but it's a lot of real life content, you know, and it's a lot of historical background behind it. And you're sort of running at a what I call a fast pace within the novel to keep up with everything, but also going to all these different places and sort of, you know, you do a great job of the visualization part of it as well. So big kudos on another success on that.
This is my 18th Sigma Force novel. I have to keep track. And by the way, for those that are listening and you don't have to, I don't think anybody's read my series in order. I think I'm the only one that's read them in order. Yeah. At this point, you could jump in this book, even though it's book 18 in the series, whatever backstory you need to know for this book, I'm going to tell you in this book. So you're not going to feel lost. So if you feel like jumping in this story, feel free to do so.
Absolutely. And I love that. I want to talk to you a little bit more about that later on, as far as how you keep that all sorted and fresh and the challenges behind that. So we'll get to picking your brain about how to do all this stuff a little bit. The book itself, though, as far as the fans and the audience is concerned, tell us a little bit about who are some of the people and some of the characters that we are have known to grow in love, and how are some of the new ones introduced?
Well, Sigma Force is their group of former Special Forces soldiers that were drummed out of the service for various reasons. But because of special abilities, special talents, special intelligence, they're secretly recruited by DARPA, the Defense Department's Research and Development Agency, to basically become sort of secretive field operatives for DARPA. So they got into the field and they're looking to, you know, any type of technological threats that might impinge upon the U.S. safety or global safety. Basically, I'd always describe them that they're scientists with guns, for lack of a better term, their own discipline. In this novel, I return with a couple characters that have helped Sigma in the past. That's Tucker Wayne and his military war dog, Kane. They appeared back a few books ago, and they occasionally helped Sigma out, and they helped Sigma back a couple in Kingdom of Bones, which was a Sigma book number 16, and they're back in number 18. And, you know, I like returning to those characters. Everybody's, you know, I like them. People like them. I sort of encountered that pair of characters. I did a USO tour of authors to Iraq and Kuwait during the end of the Gulf War. It was in the winter of 2010. And me being a veterinarian, you know, I'm seeing these guys work with their dogs out in the field. So I'm of course, going to go talk to them. And I'm saying, you know, oh, can I pet your dog? And they were like, well, we might lose a hand, but, you know, free to do so. But I love having that conversation. I was curious exactly what their relationship was like with their dogs. Did they just consider their dogs like the equivalent of a sidearm? But I found out they have a very intense relationship with their dogs. And there's a phrase they use called it runs down the lead, which means that over time, there's this bonding that occurs across the leash from handler to dog, that over time, they begin to be able to read each other without needing a hand signal or a verbal command. They just seem to sense what the other needs. And so I'm going to try to introduce that pair of characters. So I played for a while with short stories with Tucker and Kane, and really, I just could not seem to glom onto the right way of dealing with them. And then I realized the problem was I was only writing from one side, one end of that leash. I was always writing from the point of view of Tucker, the handler. And I realized it's not really fair to the military war dog. So I thought, I'm going to write scenes from the dog's point of view. So I want to have scenes, you know, to try to capture, you know, what it means to be a military war dog, and not do a Disney version of the war dog, where the war dog breaks out into song halfway through the novel. I wanted to make it authentic. You know, what senses are they using? How are they responding? You know, what are their, you know, how do they, what do they think of what's going on? So I love sort of exposing that. So that's, you know, it took a while to figure out how to do that. I went to Lackland Air Force Base where they train these dogs. I talked to many, many different handlers. And so I tried to be as authentic as I could. And when I first introduced them, I wrote a story with Tucker and Kane. And I got a lot of feedback from readers saying, hey, you know, what Kane is doing seems unbelievable. You know, it sounds like you're over-dramatizing what these dogs could do. Whereas I was getting feedback from the handlers that I was talking to and saying, hey, Jim, we like what you did with Kane, but you're pulling the reins on him. They could actually do more than what you're describing. So as Tucker and Kane appeared in various novels and in their own novels, solo novels too, I began to explore exactly, you know, try to show exactly the true extent of what these dogs could do, because they're pretty amazing. In Archangel, I introduced a newcomer. At this point, it's always been Tucker and Kane. Initially, Tucker had two military working dogs, two brothers, Kane and Abel. Abel died during an attack in Afghanistan, so he was left with Kane. But now he's introduced with a young new dog that he's training named Marco. So it's fun being able to now write from two dogs' point of view in this novel. And I got the name Marco from military war dog handlers who said, you know, this is Marco. This is, you know, he's done these incredible things. He saved so many lives. And I was looking for a name, so I put a contest out there saying, hey, help me figure out a name for Tucker's new companion, because he's introduced as a pup in the last book, but I didn't name him in that last book. So between now and next, you know, send me names. And so this handler sent me Marco and told me Marco's history. So, of course, I had to honor Marco by having Marco appear in this novel. So they are integral to helping Sigma solve this mystery of lost continents and lost libraries.
I love that. I love that. I love they got the interaction of, you know, your fans, and it'll be real curious to see about what they think about the connection now. You know, you mentioned that you're overdoing it a little bit because they haven't experienced that. They haven't been the handlers. They haven't been in those situations. But now that they actually get a chance to name the new pup, the new dog, I wonder if they're more connected with that.
Well, I got 3,000 entries, a little over 3,000 entries of people submitting names. So I have 3,000 different names for this dog. So I had to pick, you know, which out of the 3,000, who am I going to pick? Of course, I picked Marco because it, you know, I had to honor Marco's, you know, efforts to keep everybody safe out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had to ask you then when Abel made the transition, you know, in the novel and made the transition, did you get 3,000 more letters asking you why this happened?
Well, that happened before we meet Tucker. Cause I mean, that was hard because it's a brutal scene. Even my editor, when I first wrote the Abel death scene, which is told in the past since the backstory to Tucker, we meet Tucker. He's on the run. He's fled with his dog. He was so traumatized for the loss of Abel that he takes his dog and runs. So he's AWOL basically. So the course of the novel, he has to sort of, you know, come back to deal with all that. So I was traumatized by writing it. So that I wrote a novella that you can read in an anthology collection called Unrestricted Access, where there is some resolution to what happened with Abel. I'm not going to tell you what happens there, but this has been a major traumatic moment for Tucker. And so this is his coming to terms with his death of his dog in that novella. Cause I had to go through that. So I had to get it on paper and put it out there just so that, I can feel better about, the resolution with Tucker, Cain, and Abel.
That's a great way to do it. I mean, that's fantastic. And so, you know, as a writer, I know that you mentioned the characters and going back and bringing some new characters in, but keeping the existing ones. I mean, you become intimate with these characters. They're just not names on a paper that you type in. You
not
know
at all.
These characters. They've become part of who you are.
It's, you know, I always tell people that I didn't want to do a series. If you look at my biography of books, all my early books are standalone thrillers. I resisted doing a series because I had a problem with what I call the Jessica Fletcher syndrome. And here's this woman from Murder, She Wrote that's, you know, from Cabot Cove that's always stumbling over dead bodies. I've never stumbled over a dead body. So you begin to question, what is her problem? It's also hard to maintain jeopardy in a series character like that. Because if, let's say, somebody puts a gun against Jessica's head in an episode, you know the trigger's never going to be pulled because I just read the TV guide and found out that there's going to be another episode. You survive. So when I created the Sigma Force universe, it was because I wanted to base it on a group of characters. So I've done horrible things to my characters over the course of this. I want everybody at jeopardy. I want anybody to feel that any character is safe. There's been major deaths during the course of the series because I want it to be realistic that, you know, I didn't want my characters to be superhuman. But at the same time, there's a core group that's been there from the beginning, obviously. And it's fun to grow with them. That's one of the joys of the series is that it's hard to really encompass the full extent and breadth of a life within a single novel. But over the course of 18 novels, we do get to see the journey of these characters, who they were from the beginning to who they are 18 books later. There's arcs within the series of their personal lives that sort of mesh with what's going on from the thriller standpoint. So it's fun to be able to explore their life over the course of so many books.
Yeah, and when one meets their demise, I mean, what's the pressure? I mean, I know you have to go with the flow. It's not like, okay, I'm tired of him, I'm gonna get rid of him. It's with the flow of what you're trying to get through with the novel.
I've done fake outs where I pretended to kill a character at the end of a book, and oh, the hate mail that followed. Read the next book.
There you go. I was wondering, is it like it's like Michael Myers. You can't kill him off. You know, it's Freddy Krueger. You can't kill him off. They'll always come back. So that's fantastic. Well, then you mentioned just a moment ago about you never had any plans of writing a series. And obviously it's been a hugely successful series. And we continue to look forward to the next one and the next one. And I saw through your publicist that the series is in process of being developed into a TV series.
Well, let's, you know, knock on wood. If there's wood somewhere around here, there's wood.
Yeah.
So Amazon, MGM Studios picked up not just the one book, they picked up the entire Sigma Force universe. You know, every story, every short story, every novel. So they seem invested. At this point, Oakhurst Entertainment, Leonardo DiCaprio's Apian Way is involved in the project. So, you know, hopefully we'll see it get greenlit. But of course, you know, Hollywood's fickle. You know, we'll see if that actually makes it to the air. But it's sort of flattering to get this close to that finish line. So hopefully we'll see that happen.
Yeah. And well, hopefully we will. I can see it because when I read through your novels, that's, you know, I see that. I mentioned earlier about the visualization. In my mind's eye, I can see the process and where we're going and all the places we're visiting. I think you do a fantastic job on the visualization. So seeing it come to the small screen, big screen, the streaming screen, whatever it is.
Screen.
Yeah, whatever it is, it would work out just fine. So I think that's fantastic and good luck with that. That's for sure. So we'll take a quick commercial break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with James Rollins about the book Archangel. And we'll talk to him a little bit about writing in general and even more detail. So everybody hang tight. We'll come back right after this commercial break. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio.
Hi, this is Tim Link, animal communicator and pet expert, and host of Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have you ever wanted to know what your pet is really thinking? Do you want to find out if they truly understand what you're trying to tell them? Or wish you could build a better understanding and closer relationship with your pet? Well, now you can. Learning to Communicate with Animals is a 4-part on-demand workshop. In the workshop, you'll learn the essential techniques that are necessary to communicate with animals, including what is animal communication, breathing correctly to achieve the perfect state to communicate with your animals at a deeper level, using guided meditation exercises as a method to communicate with animals, and how to send and receive information from your animals. So if you're wanting to learn how to communicate and connect with your animals at a deeper level, visit PetLifeRadio.com/workshop and purchase and download Learning to Communicate with Animals. You'll be glad you did.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Continue our conversation with number one New York Times bestselling author James Rollins and his latest book, Archangel. We briefly talked about animals in the book, so before I even forget here, we got to talk about animals in your life. You know, are there some at your footsteps keeping you straight in line, not talking nonsense, and are any of them your muse? So who do we have in the menagerie?
I've got Charlie, who's right. Well, I know he took off. He was here a second ago. He's a rescue out of Las Vegas. It was sort of a point of purchase. I was getting dog food for my other dog, Echo. And, had a, no-kill shelter. Exactly. It was
reeling you.
Come on with me, Charlie. And then I have Echo. She's a almost 13-year-old golden retriever. So she's getting up there in age, but she's still tough. You know, I just got him back from, swimming in the lake just a moment ago. So that she loves to throw the ball in the lake, and she just trucks along, keeps up with Charlie, who's only 3, but she doesn't let up.
Fantastic. I love that. And I talked just sort of tongue in cheek there about them being your muse and everything. But, as a writer, I have found, obviously I love animals. I always have animals around me as well. And I always find that they know when to come in. You know, when I'm writing a piece, a short story, writing a book, whatever it is, they come in and help me maintain focus without me even knowing it. And then when it's time to go, sometimes I don't know it's time to go. They're like, okay, it's time to go. And it's more of sometimes it's because, they got to go to the lake and fetch the ball or run in the backyard. But sometimes I think they do actually work as your muse, and also it's like, okay, you've been at this thing too long. Get up and stretch your legs.
There's been a lot of studies on the human-animal bond that, if you pet a dog, your blood pressure goes down, or pet a cat, your blood pressure goes down. I think just having your animal in your life, it just makes your life richer. It makes me get and move around. I would not have, climbed those 42 steps down to the lake without the dogs being there. I thought, skip it. So, they insist that I go hiking. They keep me moving. They keep me motivated. I can't imagine life without.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly there. It reminded me when you were talking about the handlers, going overseas and talking about the handlers and the war dogs and learning from that and then putting it into your book, that special bond that they have. It really goes, I do believe it's a heart connection. It's a telepathic connection that they have, knowing what to do without even mentioning any words or commands. And then that tends to carry over, hopefully, later on when the when the military life is over and they come back, hopefully the military dogs will be able to come back with them, and we see all kinds of great stories about when they get reunited again.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine having that type of a deep bond when you're out in the field, because these guys, you know, they sleep with the dogs, they live with the dog, they eat with the dogs. I mean, that dog is at their side all the time. And, you know, I can't imagine, you know, and this is one of the things I bring up when I deal with why Tucker had to take off with Kane, is that, you know, he was basically just about to end his career, and but Kane still had years to work, and he just, after losing Abel, he was not going to put, you know, Kane at that risk. So he took off with Kane, because I can't imagine what it's like to break that bond after you had that type of connection over, you know, so many years or so many, you know, tours of duty.
Yeah, I don't know how they would do it either. You know, it's amazing, because you do, you know, you go into it knowing it's a partnership, you've got a job to do. So, you know, you have to take that seriously, but that heart connection's still there. And so when you do have to deploy elsewhere or come back to, say, the States, and you ended your tour, to me, that I'd have to get a large duffel bag and put my pal in it. Exactly. I don't think I could come back otherwise. So, James, when everybody picks up a copy of the book Archangel, is there, with this book and the series, is there something, the main theme you're hoping they walk away with? Is there something that at the end of the day, when your fans come back, say, hey, love the story, but here's what I really got out of it that makes you happy?
Yeah, I mean, this story deals a lot with mythology, you know, the mythology of this lost continent. And at one point, a character in my book says, myths can move mountains, and mythology still controls our lives today. Where's the inspiration to start this book was I read that the mythology of a lost continent in the Arctic is a major driving force for Russians' expansionist philosophy. There's a Russian philosopher called Alexander Dugin, very influential. He's taught in all the universities, all the war colleges. He's also described as Putin's Rasputin, or Putin's brain sometimes. He's that influential. And he wrote a book called The Hyperborea Theory. And Hyperborea is the name of the continent that supposedly is somewhere lost in the Arctic. And he firmly believes that the Russian people are descendants of that lost continent. And as a consequence, they have full rights to the extent of the Arctic, because that is their homeland. So it feeds into this expansionist philosophy of Russia. So I just like to sort of expose things like that about how mythology still sort of influences us today, and how that's for better or worse. But ultimately, of course, you know, my goal is to, I want to entertain you. You know, it's a popcorn story. It's full of adventure, full of, you know, crazy action set pieces that would require a very large FX budget. So, you know, good luck, Amazon, in trying to get that on the screen. Like, one thing I love about writing is I have an unlimited special effects budget writing my stories. So there's huge action set pieces, a lot of shocking things that are going to be revealed in the story. But ultimately, at the end of the book, I have a sort of a what's true, what's not section, where I lay out exactly what's true in my story, what's not, because a lot of the times what sounds fantastical in my story is actually reality. As they say, truth often is, you know, stranger than fiction. And so I hope that, you know, when they close that book, that they're left a little bit with something to think about. And one of the greatest compliments I get from a reader or somebody says, hey, you know, I love that book, it was really entertaining. But that this aspect of that story that you brought up at the end really intrigued me. I like the references you left. I followed up with my own. So I like the fact that I've intrigued somebody enough, I've piqued their curiosity enough for them to continue their own research into whatever aspect, whether it's science or history, that are raised in a novel.
Yeah. And that leads to the, you know, the sort of the research part of it. Going into writing the next novel, is there certain scenes, certain bits that you have uncovered, or you personally have thought, hey, I don't know anything about that. I've heard about this, but I don't really know anything about it. And you do the research inside that needs to go into the book, or is it something that flows along the way that you think, okay, I got to have a piece, some mysterious piece in here or something?
It's a combination of both. I mean, I front load a lot of my research, about 90 days. I commit to writing, to doing my research on a novel, on the science, the history, the locations. By the 91st day, I have to start writing. If I don't, otherwise, I just keep researching. I think I'm working, but at that point, I'm just playing. But of course, every single page I write, there's details. You know, when you're dealing with the modern world, people are going to call you if you get that detail wrong. But that city or that place, you want to make sure you're factual. Even if I can't physically travel there, I want to make sure whether I go on Google Earth and look at it visually, whether I can find somebody that's willing to talk to me, that's locally, that can give me some verisimilitude or some details that I can add to the novel, I'll do that. I love researching, but I'm also a bit of a lazy researcher. I would rather people tell me things than have me look it up. Especially when it comes to the science. A lot of times people have noted that, gosh, you know, you write this book and then like 3 or 4 months later or a year later, there's all these articles coming out on that exact topic you raised in that novel that I thought was fantastical and you were making it up, but now it looks like it's real. Jim, are you clairvoyant? No, I'm not. I just talked to that scientist, you know, a year before I was writing that novel, and I was like, I'm interested in this topic. And trust me, if you talk to a scientist and you say you're interested in their topic, they are glad to tell you anything because, you know, their wives or their husbands do not want to hear about it. But if I'm an avid interested party, they're going to answer almost anything. But the question I like to ask is, you know, don't tell me what's in your next research article or the book you're working on. You know, look over your shoulder. You know, tell me what's on your lab table right now, because I know that it's going to take me a while for this book to get published. And science changes over the, you know, rather rapidly. Stuff becomes old or wrong. So I need to have that immediacy that I need to find out, you know, what's cutting edge, was just beyond the horizon. So when it appears in my novel, it doesn't feel like, oh, that's old news. I remember that from me last year. I want to feel like this is, I'm giving you information that you don't have access to. I'm opening that door into that lab that, you know, maybe you're not allowed to go into, but I'm going to take you through that door.
Right. So it's starting, it's fresh, but sort of like, I guess I view it as like pre-fresh. It's exactly. Being there. Not most people know about it, but soon enough, everybody's going to know about it and you're going to be on the cutting edge by having it in the book. So very, very cool. I love that listening about the research parts of it because, you know, I deal with a lot of authors that write novels and, you know, of various types, whether they're thrillers or whether they're probably not Disney ones that often, though I think I have interviewed a lot of those. But the ones that really get into the research, they get into it. You know, they love that aspect of it and digging through things. Some will spend, you know, hours and days on end at a library because the only research that's available are in, you know, still stacks of books at the local or regional or national library. Some want to be where it is. If I'm writing about a particular location or a particular topic that maybe I know a little bit about, but not a lot, I'm going to go there. Or I'm going to talk to the people and spend some time with them so I get to really know their heartbeat. And it sounds like you do a little bit of that, but picking lazy spots first.
I always find that, you know, I love hearing, you know, firsthand account. I wrote a book called Sandstorm, actually the very first, it was sort of the prequel to the Sigma 4 series where Sigma was introduced, but it takes place in the country of Oman. And I never been to Oman. I couldn't afford to go because at that point I was not, you know, wasn't making enough money to afford to go to fly out to Oman and run around and do research. So I found somebody that was selling Omani products online. And I contacted him and said, hey, you know, I'm interested in writing a book about your, fictional book about your country, but I need sort of boots on the ground. I need somebody that will tell me details that I'm not going to find anywhere else. Will you be willing to help me? And he said, sure, you know, but I need to ask you first, are you going to be derogatory of our country? And I said, no, you know, my books are generally travelogues. You know, even though this book takes place in Russia, you're going to find that, you know, there's both good and bad people in Russia. In Archangel, there you're going to see both of that. So I'd like to make my books more of a travelogue. So once I told him, I said, that's cool. Yeah, I'll help you out. And so, I began to have this exchange with him. And about a month later, I get this note in the mail. It's a beautifully, you know, calligraphy. It's all stylized. It's an invitation from the Sultanate of Oman to come to his country for a personal tour, all expenses paid.
Oh, my.
So I'm thinking, well, this is fantastic. I'll get all my boots on the ground myself when I go there. But unfortunately, that was just before a certain date, 9/11.
Oh, boy.
Then about 2 weeks after that, maybe not the best time to come right now. So again, I had to lean on this gentleman that was willing to help. And people that have read Sandstorm said, hey, when were you in Oman? You know, I was in Oman. I was working for an oil company. And, you know, what years were you there? I was never there. So you don't necessarily have to travel to be a writer. I mean, you can get enough details if you're diligent enough with your research. And one of the details I thought was really interesting that I don't think I would ever find online. And this guy told me that every day at noon, the Sultanate was schooled in Britain. So at noon every day, every radio station has to play classical music. No matter if it's a talk radio station, whether it's a rock radio station, at noon, you have to play classical music. I would never found that unless I was talking to this gentleman. I mean, that's not something you're just in the newspaper somewhere from looking online. So it's just details like that I think made that person think, oh, he actually was from there because he knew that classical music was played on every radio station at noon. So it's great being able to, you know, go on the internet and look stuff up. It's great going to the libraries, but I still, you know, firmly believe it, you know, sometimes just having the living experience of the of that person, whether it's a scientist, historian, a local living in that town, to bring that level of authenticity to your story.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're living it, or they have the background of it. And I'm sure there's tidbits that they know, like you said, that nobody would know about. You, even if you went there, yeah, if you happen to stumble across the radio station at 12 noon, maybe you'd ask, yeah, what's this? Well, otherwise, you probably wouldn't even know it if you were even in the country. So, yeah. So I think more stories based in the Seychelles and Fiji and...
Ready to do some research.
Yeah, I'm thinking, yeah, there we go. All right. Well, everybody pick up a copy of the book. It's the latest in the Sigma Force novel series by James Rollins. It's Archangel. You're going to love it as always. Love the characters, love the action, love the animals in there as well. And it's just a constant thrill ride of places you're going to go and things you're going to learn and things you're going to research based on the research of the book. So James, fantastic job on the book again. And I'm so glad to have you back on the show. And I'm going to look forward to getting you back on here a little sooner next time.
Excellent. Thanks, Tim.
All right. We're coming to end the show today. I want to thank everyone for listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. I want to thank the producers and sponsors for making this show possible. If you have any questions, comments, ideas for the show, you can drop us a line at PetLifeRadio.com. And while you're there, check out all the other wonderful shows and hosts. It's a cornucopia of animal fun. It's at PetLifeRadio.com. So until next time, write a great story about the animals in your life. And who knows, you may be the next guest on Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have a great day.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.